Celebration 25. 25 years of making new friends, of holding hands with Southern California. News, information, and entertainment. Join Celebration 25 with
Bill Jenkins.
Well, welcome to a Saturday night on KBC. It's been a while since we've had a three-hour show to do it. And from now till midnight, it's you and me. Our scheduled guests tonight, and they have not yet arrived, and I don't know whether they'll make it or not, I hope they will, is Drs. Lee and Vivian Glanton. And we'll talk about the reality of the intervention with them when they get here, the authors of Heirs to the Gods. But until such time as they do, we can talk about that. Perhaps you're familiar with the Heirs of the Gods. We've had some really sparkling hours with Lee and Vivian before. To give you an idea of what the subject matter was and perhaps to provoke your imagination just a little bit, we have heard time and time again and seen time and time again ancient artifacts, the pyramids, the plains, the Nazca Plains, all over the world, in which there were hieroglyphics and there were writings and there was all kinds of communication being made that we did not know what it meant. However, as a race, that our intelligence increased, we began to understand those things. We began to see hieroglyphics that came out of Egypt and out of Mesopotamia and that area that were rockets, as if the ancients were drawing us pictures of rockets that they had seen. We saw the Nazca Plains. We wondered what that was. As we look at them from great distances, we see that those are huge runways that were built. And, of course, the many revelations that are within the pyramids. Well, Drs. Lee and Vivian Glanton went to another such artifact, which was well known. And using their expertise in archaeology, and cryptology, in etymology, the study of words, in many different disciplines, they found an amazing story in this artifact. An amazing story about a group of people who came here 35 or 40,000 years ago to colonize this planet. They came from a planet that was in orbit around the star Arcturus. But they didn't colonize this planet, or intend to colonize this planet, by bringing their people down here and starting a colony. What they did instead was to set off a section of this planet and perfectly control it, so that no weather could come in and they could control everything about it, like we would do in a laboratory here. And they built a new species of living thing, and they did that by taking the DNA molecule of the indigenous primates that lived on the planet at this time, combining them with their own DNA molecule. And with that DNA base, we're able to actually replicate a whole different human being, which I think in archaeology we would refer to him as the Cro-Magnon man. And he was totally different from anything else that was on the planet at the time, because he had a lot of the attributes of these people from Arcturus, who, of course, were highly advanced. Stood up straight, for one thing. Had a smaller cervical cavity, for another thing, in order to achieve the standing up straight. And we find out in this particular artifact a lot about what happened there. The task force commander, if I can use that term, if you will, who was highly regarded in this celestial society, was very deeply involved with what was happening on the earth, but he had very great differences of opinion with his supreme commander. And he violated one of the cardinal rules in the development of these new civilizations, and evidently this society did it all along. And that was that he allowed for by a DNA mix in the diet, for the development of the cerebral cortex of these new human beings that they were doing, that they were making here, which in turn created nothing more than smart animals, which was not the idea in the beginning. They were to be brought along as physical beings first, and then slowly their mental attributes would be allowed to grow, but they grew prematurely that way. The process here then, because it was a violation of the rules and the standing orders, caused the supreme commander of that group to relieve him of his command, but he thought he was very right. And there was actually a battle here, a space battle involved, as he was relieved of his command by another commander. All of this took a lot of time, and the technology that the space people had brought to the planet had to be lifted off the planet because a launch window had been reached. And rather than kill off the experiment, because indeed those were human beings and they didn't really know what was going on, they were allowed to live otherwise. It's a fascinating story. And that story comes right out of the pages of the Bible. And we know some of the players, according to this research. The task force commander who went astray, violated the rules, created the problem, has a name. His name was Lucifer. His commander, the supreme commander of this group, was headquartered in the planet that revolves around Arcturus, had a name also. Jehovah. Lucifer was succeeded in his command by Michael. Jehovah had an aide-de-camp by the name of Gabriel. And later, a pure clone of Jehovah was made many thousands of years later, whom we know as Jesus. So it's a fascinating story that the Gladdens have to tell. And I hopefully they haven't been delayed in some way that we can't get to that. So that was what we were going to talk tonight. I'm very familiar with it. You'll find it in one of the most marvelous books you can ever read called Heirs of the Gods. And we wanted to talk about that. And if you've read Heirs or if you have some more questions about that or any of the other things, by the way, until Drs. Lee and Vivian Gladden get here, you're certainly welcome to call in and let's you and I have a lot of conversation about that. But you don't need to limit it to that particular subject. We've been into free energy. We've been into firewalking. We've been into the out-of-body experience. We've been into all of that. And it's just you and me, and let's talk. In Los Angeles, the number is 520-TALK, T-A-L-K. All the numbers end in talk. In the San Fernando Valley, and that includes the Simi Valley, and all the way down to Santa Monica and West Los Angeles, your number is 990-TALK, and I'd love to talk to you about whatever is on your mind in that area. If you're down in Orange County, your number is 750-TALK. And if you're in Pasadena, Glendale, and Burbank, you can call in at 244-TALK, T-A-L-K. Our lines are open, and we're ready to talk to you. Out in the San Gabriel Valley, call us. We have plenty of time to talk about it all. The number is 448-TALK there. If you're down in the South Bay area, Manhattan Beach, Palos Verdes, Redondo Beach, Rolling Hills, Torrance.
I'm hoping that he might have lectures or demonstrations at some of the local colleges, such as UCI, mm-hmm. You know, something like that.
That, as far as I know, that's not in his plans at this present time, but there certainly will be, once it gets into its commercial phase, an enormous amount of information available to you. There is a lot of work that has to be done in order to satisfy and placate the bureaucrats and all of the others, because the idea that you can have all of the energy you can possibly need in your home for free, other than paying for the device and having its maintenance, of course, shakes at the very foundation of a lot of economic bases. They'd rather you do what you're doing now.
Could you tell me the approximate size and weight of the device?
It'll be about half the size as it looks right now from the last information I have. Of the average air conditioner thing that sticks outside the house, in the ground, if you have a central air conditioning unit.
Was that the size of the unit that he had at his demonstration at town?
No, that unit was smaller. That's a breadboard. That's a very, very crude device. Certainly wasn't able to produce enough energy to power a home, although it'll do a lot. Basically a breadboard model.
Could it possibly power a refrigerator or a stereo? I'm sort of interested in building one of these things, so I'd like to be able to hook it up to
smaller versions, which are certainly planned. They will be small enough that they will sell those to the manufacturers of refrigerators and air conditioning units, and whenever you buy those units, you don't plug them in. You just turn them on.
Well, if I was to purchase the plans through Tesla Book Company, would I be able to take those plans and, after building the unit, hook it into a stereo or a refrigerator and have the thing work?
Well, not with that unit. What that unit will do is show you the theory and see how it works. And you was, if you're an inventive kind of guy, now that you understand the theory, you can elaborate on that and make one big enough to power a city if you want to, because you will see how it works. But that particular unit that you will get your schematics for is simply one that's designed to show you that you can tap the energy that's all around us. That is a gravity field, stressed, scalar wave generator.
So this generator then is portable. I could take it in my car and it'd still be running then, for instance, you know, just drive around to Santa Barbara or something.
That's right.
Huh, interesting. Thank you very much.
Okay, Jim, thank you very much for your interest. And be sure to get those plans from Tesla Book Company, if you will, and play with that if you're inclined in, you know, in electronics. It's a fascinating thing. There are a number of them working in the Los Angeles area right now.
Any ideas to when he'd be able to have a unit that could be hooked into generators or alternators? Because I gather that as is, you can't really do it. It's going to require some sort of modification to the unit itself.
What do you mean?
Well, the model that would come from the schematics from Tesla's book company,
mm-hmm.
as I understand it from what you're saying to me, is that I could not hook this thing up and have it power something.
I don't think it would power too much. It wasn't even designed to do that. Certainly in Bedini's laboratory, it has gone a lot further than that. And he's actually done what you would have the ability to do after you see how the theory works.
Mm-hmm.
You see, the theory, it seems on the surface, violates the second law of thermodynamics and the law of conservation of energy. Actually, it doesn't. It's just a keener or a more clear understanding of those. And we've been rather closed-minded about those things in the scientific community.
Well, okay, Bill. Thanks a lot.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Right. And Maria.
Oh, good evening, Bill. Your voice sounds so nice.
Well, thank you.
I enjoy your show so much. My father's 91.
Uh-huh.
He was born in Athens, Greece, and as a boy, before he came to this country, he used to lay down by the Acropolis and the Parthenon. And now he says to me all the time, how did they ever build these things so many thousands of years ago, and how did they ever build the pyramids?
No one knows how they built the pyramids. We certainly understand how they built the ancient Greek structures and some of the fascinating structures that are even in Rome, like the Colosseum in Rome was a magnificent... You know, that was the first dome stadium, by the way. That was the first Astrodome.
Is that right?
The Colosseum in Rome. Yeah.
So perfect.
And it was way ahead of its time. Fascinating things about it. When they would build the first tier of the Colosseum, for instance, for the workmen to work on the second tier, they would fill that in with dirt. And I think there were five or six tiers or something. And after they had finished it all, it was full of dirt. And they were very clever, the Romans. You know how they got that dirt removed, which would be a tremendous job today for us to remove that much dirt. Can you imagine... say the Colosseum here in Los Angeles filled with dirt, how long it would take us to get all that dirt out. It took the Romans 2 years, and it was done by hand. But you know what they did?
What?
As they were filling it with dirt, they threw gold coins in the dirt. And, of course, during the construction time, that was all guarded, and no one could get to it. And so when they wanted the dirt removed, they just said, people, take your buckets and go in there and take the dirt out, and most likely we'll find a gold coin.
Well, my great-grandfather did that in the clay pits in Athens, too, for the tiles that they made,
right.
100 years ago. They threw coins in there, and then the workers did that.
But we can understand the construction that was used, and it was certainly advanced, but they had an awful lot of slave labor in order to achieve those, and build those marvelous edifices in Athens.
But they don't know about...
And pyramids are still a mystery. There is a prevailing thought now that perhaps those stones were actually cast stones. And one of the reasons that they feel that, and they really haven't proved it, but they have shown in checking some of those stones that hair is in the stone. And the only way you could have hair in the stone is for it to have been cast.
Yeah.
And the stones, of course, were perfect, and they line up with each other. They very well may have been cast stones. Heretofore, we had thought that they came from a quarry that was located quite a distance to the south. And in getting those stones of that size to the pyramid site is something that we can't even do right now. As well as build the pyramids. If you were to give our largest construction companies or a conglomerate of them all of the budget they wanted, and it is the wealth of the world, they still couldn't build those pyramids.
I always had a strange feeling they had some kind of an electrical force that we don't know about that lifted these things.
They had something that we don't have, whether it was mental power, a different kind of power.
I think it was.
Technology that is lost to us, we don't know.
Well, I hope maybe tonight they'll bring... I love to hear about the pyramids.
Mm-hmm.
So so I'll be listening.
Okay.
Thanks so much, Bill.
Thank you very much, Maria, for calling.
All right.
I'm Bill Jenkins. It's Open Mind on a Saturday night. We are anxiously awaiting the appearance of Drs. Lee and Vivian Gladden, and we will get into this magnificent story I just kind of touched upon with you that's found in their book, Heirs of the Gods. But until I get here, we'll talk to you about anything that's on your mind, those things that we generally touch on these Saturday nights when it's time for Open Mind. How are you?
Better turn down my radio. No, I don't think I have to.
You're okay.
I was listening to you a little while ago, and there was something you said about the Bible. I'm not really familiar about everything in the Bible for sure. You know,
mm-hmm.
I read, there's a lot of different things. I want to know.
I'm waiting, Larry.
Yeah. I think I better hang up, but I wanted to get that show below my head. You know, this guy upstairs, every time I start listening, you know, he stamps on the floor. So that's about all I needed. Is that okay?
I suppose. Okay, Larry. That's all right. Hope Larry gets it all figured out. Let me give you the numbers if you want to call. We do have...
I have a question about John Bedini's machine.
Sure, go ahead.
That he doesn't have a patent on it, right?
John has made all of the basic scientific innovations that are accumulation of his work. He certainly used a lot of the ideas of Nikola Tesla,
mm-hmm.
of T. Henry Moray, of Thomas E. Bearden. Those are all in the public domain.
Oh, they are.
Number one, you cannot get a patent in the United States for a machine that violates the second law of thermodynamics. They just won't give it to you.
Well, what about that other... Oh, excuse me. Go ahead.
It's snake oil, but the fact that it works is immaterial. So it's been put in the public domain, and life goes on anyway, despite what the bureaucrats in Washington think.
What about the other gentleman that was also applying for a patent on the free energy concept? Would that, if he did eventually get awarded that patent, would that affect John's machine? And
not at all. You're talking about the Joe Newman device.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Joseph Newman down in Loosedale, Mississippi, has indeed developed a magnetic type of device that does power itself.
Mm-hmm.
And it has been proven that it powers itself. They have gone to court, and even the masters in the court have said, yes, it does what it says it's supposed to, but he still can't get a patent on it yet. And that whole thing is up in the air. The difference in Joe Newman's device and John Bedini's device is quite simple. Joe Newman's device develops a massive amount of torque, and the Bedini device develops electricity.
Mm-hmm.
And there is a need for both of those kind of machines, and the great need being that you do not have to buy fuel in order to make them work.
Yeah.
They are using massive amounts of fuel, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
They are not, we say, free energy device, free because you don't have to pay for oil or something like that. They're getting the energy from the energy that is around us at all time.
Mm-hmm.
They are not perpetual motion machines. There is no such thing. I guess the nearest thing to a perpetual motion machine is a celestial body like the Earth. And who knows, one day it may run down as far as that goes. But the term perpetual motion machine was something that was fabricated around the turn of the century to belittle the science that was available even at the turn of the century for these type devices, which would, of course, preclude the great use of petroleum and the other things that we use.
What's the current plans as far as having the first commercial one available on the market?
They're going full tilt. It's a difficult job to do that. It's being handled very well, and there will be some rather startling announcements, I think, in the not-too-distant future for it.
Do you mean within this year?
That is the plan. I would bet on it.
Oh, great. Okay.
All right, does that help you?
Yeah, sure.
All right,
thanks very much, Bill.
Mike, I appreciate your interest.
Okay.
Lucille.
Yes.
Huh?
Good evening. I'm very much interested in this generator.
Mm-hmm.
I'm 79 years old, and I depend on dividends from utility stocks.
Mm-hmm.
What is going to happen to them?
Well, if you are a stockholder in a utility company, this is probably one of the best pieces of information you ever had in your life. As these devices start moving into usage around the country, their first impact on the utility companies will be a lessening in its demand curve for electricity, which means that the stockholders will not be saddled with the enormous, costly job of capital formation to build more Diablo Canyons. And they won't have to do that, so as a stockholder, you will be much better off. Secondly, the devices, though they are made at initially the size that would power just the electrical needs of your home, they also can be made such a size that it would provide the utility company with all of the electricity it needs, and they would be getting that electricity for free, other than the cost of the generator itself and the maintenance thereof. And those cost savings can be passed on to the consumers, but at the same time, the stockholders will have a valid and very good investment. So it will stop you having to spend, as a stockholder, massive amounts of money on petroleum and all of the other things that you're doing in nuclear power in order to serve the needs of your customers.
Then it isn't a duplication of what Tesla went through in his day when he was fought so seriously.
Hopefully that will not happen again. That was one of the saddest moments of capitalism.
Indeed it was. I just wondered if there might be a duplication of that again.
You can rest assured that it will not be allowed to happen again.
Mm-hmm. May I ask you something else?
Mm-hmm.
Have you experienced the out-of-body that you wanted to do so badly?
I'm glad you asked, Lucille, and the answer is no.
You haven't?
I have not yet gone out-of-body.
Oh.
Well, I suppose, I'm told we all go out of body every night, but I mean, as a conscious experience.
I know, but you wanted to for so long.
Yeah.
I had hoped that by now you had made it.
Well, I haven't given it up. I have just kind of put it on the back burner.
Well, thank you very much, and good luck.
All right, Lucille, thank you very much. And as a stockholder of a utility company, you're going to be...
I'll be all right. Well, after all, I'm 79, so I guess it doesn't matter too much. I was just curious.
Okay, thank you very
much. Thank you.
I'm Bill Jenkins. It's Open Mind. I'll be back in just a moment.
Well, Bill, I've read the Gladden's book, and I find it a fascinating book.
Isn't it?
Yes, it really is. But I have some questions for you personally, if that's okay.
We'll try.
Okay. Do you believe that Satan or a fallen celestial actually exists?
We know that there is a force out there that is causing man to do himself in.
Uh-huh. But the Gladdens talk about actual people.
Well, you have to understand that the point of reference is the Bible.
Right.
Only. And they're not trying to be mystic or any of these things. They're simply relating what the etymology of these ancient texts are showing us. And they use a lot of ancillary texts along with that, the ancient writings of the Mesopotamians and the others. And that story that they're telling you in there about Lucifer and how he was banished then from this whole activity and was actually put in exile until such time as they can come back and deal with him is what their research is showing them that the Bible is saying.
Uh-huh. Well, if we assume that Lucifer actually does exist, wouldn't he be a very deceptive person and, probably more intelligent than us?
Well, you certainly can imagine. Now, one of the premises of the Bible where the people from Arcturus, or the Arcturans, or the Celestials, you want to call them that, certainly were enormously advanced in bioengineering, and their lifespan was... indefinite because of the procedures that they used. And those life-generating procedures, by the way, were one of the things we would talk about tonight with the Gladdens as they have found it in the Bible.
Uh-huh.
So to answer your question, yes, they would. He would be a very, very advanced person that would be among us, certainly with that technology and with that great insight.
Well, I wouldn't want you to take this next question wrong, but I'm really concerned about this. Because of the possibility of this actually being the case. But I really do enjoy your show. But how can you be sure that Satan isn't behind some of the things like firewalking and out-of-body experiences and belief in reincarnation and things like that?
Oh, my goodness gracious. Okay. That Satan is behind firewalking. That Satan is behind... You know, Satan's probably behind the banking system.
Probably so.
you can now take a mystic jump if you want to and come up with something that is ethereal and give it the name Satan and then let that be the progenitor of everything that is not constructive and evolving for humankind on the earth.
Uh-huh.
Which is not the point. Now, a lot of people have those belief systems, and if they want to have them, that's fine. That's not necessarily mine. I don't think that there's necessarily a great force that's controlling all of that. I think that there are a lot of people whose very basic nature has caused them to be the destructive ones in our society.
Uh-huh.
But whether they're being manipulated by this spiritual entity called Satan or not is something I think that's still up for conjecture.
Do you have any rule of thumb that you go by to, for lack of a better way of putting it, to keep yourself from evil?
Oh, yes. I think if you're not doing anything that you do should be motivated by love. All right, now,
uh-huh.
We want to get away from, again, a mystic term of love. I use love in another way. As a love is a thought that creates energy that is in total harmony with the nature, character, and personality of the energy of the universe. Because when you think a thought, it creates energy. Now, if that energy is harmonious with everything around you, then your actions are going to be harmonious, or they're going to be loving. And I believe that you must be very diligent about the way you think. And in so doing, then you are going to be, and what we would see on the surface, as a very loving person. And you owe it to your spiritual self as well as your physical self to conduct yourself in that way all the time.
So what you're saying, then, is you achieve that through diligence in thought?
That's right.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
All right, Paul. Thank you very much for those questions. The good ones.
Yep.
And we have Daniel on the line. Hi, Daniel.
Hi, it's Danielle.
Oh, Danielle.
Yes.
Excuse me.
Female version.
All right.
Last year when I was working for the company that produced the Philadelphia story,
mm-hmm.
I was in touch with you, and you said that a movie was going to be made.
There's certainly one on the drawing boards for Heirs of the Gods.
Yes, and that there was a three-dimensional technique involved.
The technique is being developed now, and the studio is being developed in Houston.
Ah.
And for that, a movie like Heirs of the Gods would be impossible for Hollywood to make with
right.
the current technology to do properly. I suppose that you could do it. This, of course, is a decision that the Gladdens have to make. I know some of the people who are involved in wanting to do that project, but it hasn't even gotten to the point yet where we can sit down and start doing a lot of pre-work on it yet.
In other words, there's no script or...
Oh, there are certainly some trial scripts out there that are fascinating, but nothing that is of any validity at all.
Okay.
And I'm sure that the Gladdens would like to see that happen as well as anyone else.
Uh-huh. How about the financial backing or any interest in a release from the major motion pictures after it's been done?
Oh, after it's been done?
Uh-huh.
Well, I would imagine that that particular aspect of producing the movie will be taken care of the original agreements with the Gladdens and the movie makers themselves. They certainly want to distribute it.
Okay. Did you also say that this new 3D technique didn't require glasses?
That's true.
Oh, that sounds exciting. Have you seen this work? Is there new equipment designed?
I have seen it work. It's fascinating to watch it.
Oh.
And,
in other words, if you could go ahead and shoot the movie right now,
mm-hmm.
you could do it in that technique and release it. It's not...
The technology is, yes, it's there.
Ready to go. Well, that sounds...
We wouldn't say it's ready to go into a full-scale motion picture yet, but the technology is there.
Uh-huh. Well, that sounds very exciting. I'll be looking forward to that.
Oh, so are we all.
Okay.
All right, Danielle. Thank you very much.
Bye-bye.
I'm Bill Jenkins. It's Open Mind.
Yes.
Hello, Leota.
Hi, how are you? I haven't read the Gladden's book, Heirs to the Gods, but is it similar to Zachariah Sitchin's The Twelfth Planet?
You know, there are some really minor similarities. Zachariah's works came out of the ancient Babylonian Sanskrit.
Yes, I know.
Uh-huh. And those writers that date back 5,000 years or so
mm-hmm.
were either great science fiction writers or they were talking about something. And if I can just thumbnail what Zachariah was saying in The Twelfth Planet, that there is another planet in the solar system.
Nibiru.
And that loops into here every 3,600 years. And during these close proximities to the inner planets of our solar system, there will be a lot of space travel between that planet and the Earth.
Right.
And there's quite a tale about the two brothers who were in charge, and they had fights.
Yes, Ian and Lil.
They created a species of people here to work in the mines. Because
that's us.
That's us.
We're the Lulus.
The Nephilim, as they, I think they were called,
uh-huh.
gave them the ability to procreate. I think one of the brothers got mad at the other.
Ian. Ian created us.
Right.
And then Lil had the crown.
There are some similarities in the things that Zechariah Sitchin found in those old writings to what
right.
the Gladdens are finding in the Bible. However, it is a different story altogether because what the Gladdens are dealing with is just simply what the Bible is telling us. Now, you've got to remember that those old writers were living in close proximity to each other. There may have been a lot of crosstalk in their storytelling. It's hard to say.
Uh-huh. Well, I found The Twelfth Planet a very scholarly book.
Mm-hmm.
And
Zechariah is a very scholarly man, and his Stairway to Heaven is another.
Yes, I also read that, too. Well,
on the show with me, by the way.
You mentioned that in the book Heirs to the Gods that the people arrived only 40,000 years ago.
35 or 40,000 years ago. It's hard
but Zechariah Sitchin says that the Ea and his astronauts came from Nibiru 240,000 years ago.
Could be.
Uh-huh. So they're, you know, they're much before.
You must understand also that, according to the Bible, there were other such life forms other than those that were involved with this experiment that the Bible deals itself with.
Oh, I see.
Other life forms that were growing up in the Indus Valley and in the Swan Valley of China and the Nile Valley of Africa and in North and South America. So
I look forward to hearing your interview with them.
Well, they just arrived.
Aha!
And
they're here for 10 o'clock.
I forgot to tell them. They started at 9.
Enjoy your show, Bill. Wouldn't miss it for anything.
All right, Leona.
Bye-bye.
Thank you very much. I'm Bill Jenkins. We'll be right back with Lee and Vivian Gladden in just a moment. Mark, well, we don't have time to go too much further. But I will tell you that Drs. Lee and Vivian Gladden are here, and welcome aboard, gang.
Okay.
It's
pleasure
as,
to be here, Bill.
It's as I anticipated. I forgot to tell you we started at 9, right? But we have two more hours. We want to talk about Heirs of the Gods. A lot of folks have already been talking about that, and they want to know more and more about it. So we'll just tell them all about it. We'll take a break right now for news, and then we'll be back with Drs. Lee and Vivian Gladden, who have some fascinating things to relate to you tonight that I can assure you will make you think and made me think. So you stay with. Welcome to Hour 2 of Open Mind tonight. I'm Bill Jenkins, and we'll be here till midnight. And with me, Drs. Lee and Vivian Gladden. And if you've missed their previous appearances on the show, what is it, about 3 times? You two have just electrified us at night. They've done an amazing thing with a book called Heirs of the Gods. It's spellbinding, number one. It's a kind of book I think you can read over and over again, and it triggers the imagination, seems to make a lot of sense. On the surface of it, it may fly in the face of a lot of closely held belief systems, but you really have to look and see what you had to say. Let's get why you are, you know, you call it a space age interpretation of the Bible. I like to look at it a little bit different than that, that you have been able to kind of put aside the classic interpretation that the Bible has, get down to the real science of the root meaning of the language that was used in writing the Bible by those ancient writers, who did an enormous job, who were capable of writing of things that they shouldn't have known about as well as they did and with the accuracy that they did. I know a lot of people like to attribute that to the creator of the universe inspiring them to write in that fashion. Is that the way you look at it? Either one of you.
Well, we certainly wouldn't object to the idea that they were inspired by information which came from off this earth.
Okay.
Whether or not you want to attribute this to the agency of the creator of the universe or as we suggest, to the intermediate agency, at least, of extraterrestrials that knew more, perhaps, about the creation of the universe than they did or even we do now. We feel that we found evidence in the archaeolinguistics that the writers of the Bible had knowledge that is scientifically more advanced than we know right now in the 20th century, and this is what proves that extraterrestrials were here.
Mm-hmm.
Perhaps we'd better clarify what archaeolinguistics means.
Good idea. I knew what it meant.
We know that you know what it means, Bill. It means, as you would in the field of archaeology, dig for artifacts from antiquity, in archaeolinguistics, it identifies and isolates alien intrusion into sacred texts.
Mm-hmm.
And what we're saying, and then all of the sacred literature, there is, there are records encoded that tell us of an extraterrestrial civilization millions or billions of years in our technological future, and that they have been here, as we've so often said on the show, and that they are still here, but they will manifest themselves in a return, call it the parousia or the second coming, or a visitation.
That's not too far away.
That's not too far away in our time.
Mm-hmm.
And we started with etymology, which is the study of root words, which led us to our own discoveries through the tool of archaeolinguistics.
Now, you have certainly concentrated on the Bible. Have you gone to supplementary ancient writings, too, that and artifacts or things that seem to support what you're saying?
Yes, we have, Bill. During the time we were doing the research for Heirs of the Gods, we covered, I think, a very great part of the extant literature on the Bible.
Mm-hmm.
But we also went into the sacred writings of other faiths, and in most instances, the Hindu literature, the Buddhist and Chinese literature, for example, the literature of ancient Egypt and of the Mesoamerican civilizations, we found that all of these contain the same kinds of references to extraterrestrial visitations of godlike beings who helped humanity and elevated them and taught them the arts of civilization that we found in the Bible.
There are a lot of things that are familiar in all of these writings, too, other than just the reference to the extraterrestrial, and you can see that once you have that mindset out that those things don't exist. The flood seems to appear in all of the ancient writings of all of the civilizations.
And even the literatures of Aboriginal peoples.
Mm-hmm. The Savior, one that is killed quite often on a cross. Even in China, there was a great teacher that was crucified on a cross.
The Goddess Mother, the Virgin birth.
There is that too. So, what is the intertie there in the Judeo-Christian writing? We're seeing these very same stories that appear in China and in North and South America. Why is that?
Well, in the chapter of our book called The Bible and History, we suggest that at the time that Homo sapiens was recreated by extraterrestrials and given the sapient features that mm-hmm. make us what we are today and taught the arts of civilization, or assisted at least in them, that they did acquire an extensive civilization, which later then became fragmented and was preserved piecemeal in the traditions of peoples all over the earth. And because these fragmentary parts of civilization have been preserved by separate civilizations all over the earth, but originally come from a unitary source, you do find remarkable parallels of all kinds, not just in the flood story, but in
mm-hmm.
large and extensive myth complexes and legend complexes of all kinds.
Well, are you saying then that, let's say just the flood story, for instance, that as that is revealed in the Bible, and you've done a masterful job in Heirs of the Gods on how that came about. Is that the main flood, and then that was fragmented into other societies, and they're retelling that story, but just applying it to their environment? Or was it happening all around? Is it a similarity in all of the cultures?
Of course, the first thing I think to notice about the flood story in the Bible is that when it said the flood covered the whole earth, the word used for earth there is the Hebrew word eretz, E-R-E-T-S. And that does not mean, although it's often translated earth, the planet earth, as that word always means in English. Or let me say, it can mean the planet earth, but it also can be used in a more restricted way that it is not used in English, just to mean a land or a region or a part of the earth.
Or like the Tigris-Euphrates Valley.
Right. And what we believe from the context there is that the particular Noahic flood that's described in Genesis involved just the Fertile Crescent, the land, the earth where man was recreated. However, that area has been subject to flooding over and over again from the most ancient times we know because of the way it's structured geologically, with a delta at one end, you know, and a gulf subject to monsoons at the other end. And Sir Leonard Woolley, the great Assyriologist and archaeologist, discovered, of course, back in early 1920s, evidence of a tremendous flood that seemed to fit the Genesis description in that area, in the layers that he was excavating while he was doing his work in Sumer.
Yeah, we had a terrific night, you and I and Dr. Jeffrey Goodman. Do you remember that?
Yes.
Stimulating.
About what we would call the intervention, the way that the humanoid has developed on the planet, this and all at once in a geological twinkling there appeared the Homo sapien as we know him today, or the Cro-Magnon man. And it was the contention of Dr. Goodman and Dr. Crick and some of the others that this was an intervention on the part of the extraterrestrials. It couldn't come from anywhere. There is no evolvement of the human being. We just can't see that happening any other place.
We became too much too fast for evolution as we know it to explain how we got here in the full-blown form that we appear, say, in ancient Sumer 6,000 years ago.
And for a while, the Cro-Magnon man and the Neanderthal man commingled. And the Neanderthal man lost, that particular battle, because there was the Cro-Magnon had quite a great deal more going for him.
Right. Yes, the paleontological records suggest that they actually interbred, and the Bible also suggests the same thing, we believe.
So we see then in science and in archaeology a lot of the things that are discussed in your book, there's a lot of credence to what you have to say, there seems to be. And if you can get away from the emotional tie that we have with this marvelous story that rings in our religious hearts, as it were, because we want to believe in that way. But let's get it down to some raw data. You've done sort of an amazing kind of thing there. We've never talked about the latter part of the book, the Bible's talking about the UFOs. We like to talk about the UFOs on this show. What does the Bible say about them, Vivian?
Well, the Bible has a lot to say about UFOs in its own way. In our chapter, Celestials, Prophets, and UFOs, we have a heading from Psalms that says, "To him that rideth upon the heavens of heavens, which were of old, lo, he doth send out his voice, and that a mighty voice it is." Now, we've all read about the watchers and the holy ones coming down. We know about the account of the transfiguration, entering into a cloud, and the Hebrew children going through the desert, the pillar of fire by night and the cloud by day.
And the manna dropping from heaven.
Yes, and the manna dropping from heaven. There are the scriptures that say, "Who are these that fly as clouds, as doves to a window?" And the chariots of God are 20,000, even thousands and thousands of angels. And the Lord rode upon a cherubim. Yea, he did ride upon the wings of the wind.
Mm-hmm.
And our research bears out that when it's talking about a cherub or kirub, the Hebrew word kirub or kabab, it's talking about a servo mechanism, a rotating device that can detach itself and do labor. It can transport. The Bible is just full of accounts of.
Well, I think one of the best UFO reporters I ever read, and he did the best he could with his understanding of the world he lived in, was Ezekiel.
Absolutely. Oh, yes.
Uh-huh. He was a good reporter, but he ran across some UFOs out there. When you get out of the mindset, and is this a possibility? Is this what Ezekiel was talking about? Then that makes sense, doesn't it?
Yes. In fact, the jacket flap of our book has a reference to Ezekiel's vision, as it's sometimes called, which we believe wasn't a vision at all, but an actual observation.
We've done extensive
of an entry craft
research on that chapter, first three chapters of Ezekiel, and it's fascinating, and we'd like to go into detail if we possibly can a bit this evening concerning that.
Well, let's do that right after I do this, and I have a wheel within a wheel called a commercial with a commercial.
Room, who rideth upon the heavens in help, and his excellency is in the sky that he rideth upon.
Okay.
Since you mentioned Ezekiel specifically, though, consider this excerpt from the book of Ezekiel, the third chapter. Then the Spirit took me up, and I heard behind me a voice of great rushing. I heard also the noise of wings of the living creatures that touched one another, and the noise of wheels over against them, and a noise of great rushing. So the Spirit lifted me up and took me away. And on the jacket flap of our book, we make this comment. Are these the rantings of a man whose mind had become unhinged under the stresses of exile? Or do these passages recount a flight taken by an intelligent but scientifically naive Hebrew priest who lived 2,500 years ago? Are the wheels and wings he describes figments of an overheated imagination? Or are they the landing gear and helicopter blades of an entry craft remarkably similar to ones now on our drawing board at NASA? And in the course of our chapter on celestial prophets and UFOs, we present evidence that they are indeed very similar to a design that NASA was working with before our Apollo project to the moon.
What were some of those things?
The similarities?
Mm-hmm.
Well, other than the ones mentioned right there, the fact that, for instance, the craft has wheels, apparently, that can be let down and can be pulled up again for taxiing, that the wings seem also to fold down or to fold up, or they can rotate, and that when they do, they make a great rushing noise like waters, which suggests some kind of propulsion.
A jet engine or a rocket engine? So
power, yes.
There's a rushing sound to it?
There's a remarkable description a little later in the middle sections of Ezekiel about what appears to be a refueling project that goes on that we describe, in which someone walks in between the man-like creatures, the cherubim as they're called, which we believe are propulsion units attached to this landing craft, and takes out glowing coals and then apparently puts some new fuel into the craft. Now, of course, it's sometimes argued by Bible commentators that this was just an hallucination or a religious vision or revelation that Ezekiel had, and they point to the fact that the King James Version, in fact, calls it a vision, that it's translated a vision. But the Hebrew word chazon that's used there is a word that is used not for visions. There's a different Hebrew word used for that. This is a word that's used for actual visual perception.
Mm-hmm.
The implication is that Ezekiel was actually seeing this thing, not that he was envisioning it or hallucinating it.
So when you get back to the root meaning of the words, and that's as far beyond the King James Version, which came out in 1611, we're talking about something visual and not a vision.
That's right.
And it's easy to see how the scholars of 200 or 300 years ago could get that confused.
Something visual and totally physical that has been experienced.
Would you say that the science of etymology is much more exacting now and much more accurate than it was during the time that the scholars all got together at Oxford University and gave us the King James Version of the Bible?
I would say possibly so, because as the years go on and more research is done, there are more avenues of expression in terms of ferreting out truth, mm-hmm. and new disciplines come about, such as our archaeolinguistics.
Right.
And I would say that the archaeolinguistics is the honed and refined
look at it, right?
Yes, yes, yes.
I think, as Vivian says rather cautiously, there has been certainly progress in the understanding of the Greek and Hebrew texts, although perhaps it isn't earth-shaking, even in King James' time, a good deal was known about the Hebrew and Greek. But where the tremendous breakthrough has been made, and where we're just light years ahead of what the King James scholars were, is in the linguistic tools that we have for analyzing. Things have happened particularly since World War II.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of cryptoanalytic and code-breaking techniques. For
you almost have to be a cryptologist as you get down into that.
And in terms of the decipherment of unknown languages, grid methods of analysis of the sort that were used on Linear B, for instance, the ancient Cretan language, which resisted efforts at decipherment for so long, or that were used on cuneiform by Rawlinson. These kinds of things are available to us now, which were not available in the time of the King James scholars, and we use these methods, these kinds of techniques, in our archaeolinguistics.
With our own discovery in terms of the innovation that we made, and we're just...
Well, you know, one of the things that caught my attention, I think the first time we sat down and chatted at these microphones, that was that the term that refers to the creator of the universe, when you get down into the root meaning of those words, that's only used twice in the Bible, as I recall you telling me. I believe in the first chapter. From then on, the term Lord or the Lord God or the Lord God Jehovah was a different root word. It had an entirely different meaning than the one who, the great creator of all.
Yes, we think that the language clearly indicates that there were two gods or lords that are referred to not only in Genesis but later in the Bible as well. And one of these is the ultimate creative spirit that brought the universe and life and mankind into being. And the other is one referred to in Genesis sometimes as the Lord God by a different Hebrew name, or sometimes referred to as Yahweh, which is translated Jehovah in the King James, who was apparently a flesh-and-blood astronaut, an extraterrestrial from another world, who then recreated mankind after the original creative force had brought mankind forth by an evolutionary creation. And this recreation was a literal genetic engineering recreation in an experimental garden, the Garden of Eden, and took place pretty much as it's described in Genesis 2.
I want to let the callers get to you, because I'll bet you they have some questions for you. And I want to give you the numbers right now and then take a little break and talk about the greatest clone of all time. And then we'll get to our callers, all right? You two, you startled me when you told me that, according to your research into the Bible, that a personality in history of whom I have great affinity for and great respect for and admiration for, Jesus, was a clone. Now, explain yourself. What do you mean that Jesus was a clone?
Harsh. Falls harsh upon the ears.
I said it that way on purpose. Because you treat it in a very, very loving and masterful way in the book, of course.
And it's not that we say it, really. It's that the book of John says it.
The book of John says...
The Gospel of John.
If you've seen me, you've seen the Father. I and my Father are one. And it tells us that they took up stones to stone him. And he said, well, what good work do you stone me? It's because you say you're the Son of God. And he said, well, does it not say in your scriptures that ye too are gods? Now, when the scripture says that this is my only begotten Son, in whom I am well pleased, the word begotten there in the Greek is monogenes.
Mm-hmm.
And when you look up the etymology, you get of themselves alone. And our word for cloning, which I'd really like to strike out of our vocabulary because it's come to mean something quite...
Hollywood has done it.
Yes, visually people conjure up all sorts of bizarre images. Monogenes is our word for cloning.
The third chapter of John has one of the most famous passages in the Bible, John 3:16.
Mm-hmm.
For God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son, the King James Version reads.
Mm-hmm.
And again, the word only begotten there is the King James translator's English rendition of this Greek word Vivian was speaking of, monogenes. And another English word which comes directly from that is monogenetic. And, of course, those in the audience who have studied biology or had it in school recently will recall that monogenetic reproduction is just the biologist's name for what is called cloning. And what it means is, of course, that an offspring is reproduced using the genetic material of one parent only.
Mm-hmm.
Monogenetic.
Single
in that
cell.
Sense. And in the case of John 3:16, what is meant there, contrary to what people commonly assume, is not that Jesus was the only son that God had. That's the common interpretation of, for God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten son. A more accurate translation of that Greek word, monogenes, would be that he gave his son who was begotten only of him.
Mm-hmm. And there is a difference, isn't there?
Right. What this is saying is that only the genetic material of Jehovah was used. None of Mary's was used. And, of course, the only way that could be true is if Jesus were what is commonly called a clone. In other words, if genetic material of Jehovah was somehow implanted in her uterus without using any genetic material from her ovum. And, of course, this would be the only way also that... a child could be born to a virgin, as the King James translators translated that.
Well, it even describes, I think, how that was done by the aide-de-camp, if you want to call him that.
Yes, Gabriel said that the thing used the word, the thing, this thing that will be, this is in Luke
mm-hmm.
1, chapter 1, this thing that will be born of you will be of the Holy Ghost. And you will be overshadowed. You will be overshadowed by the Holy Ghost. Well, the word there is episkiazo. Episkiazo is the Greek word. And the etymology yields the meaning of a brilliant haze that her womb was irradiated with an energy form,
the genetic code
mm-hmm.
of Jehovah and imprinted it on Mary's ovular material.
Now, Bill and our wonderful listening audience, this is not something that we said, well, now this must mean this.
Mm-hmm.
I have to go back to the fact that this is a space age interpretation of the Bible, that these things could not have been understood, many of them, until the space age and until the age of technology and high technology. And I have to also reiterate the fact that we're dealing with the etymology and our ovulinguistics.
Mm-hmm. I think in order to add just a little more understanding to what you were saying there about Jesus, how the DNA was implanted or irradiated, say, on the cervical wall of Mary.
Yeah, the material wasn't actually implanted. It's rather that
it was
the
irradiated there.
Information of mm-hmm. the material, its code, its genetic code, was transmitted by a radiant energy form and imposed on the genetic material of Mary. That's what John claims.
If we could go back to the very early days of the experiment in the Garden of Eden, this same process was used, except the process of building this new human body was now done mechanically or technologically.
Precisely.
Or in a replicator, as we would
Precisely.
You may want to call that today.
Yes.
Rather than using a human being or female as the mother or the incubator.
Man was formed from the dust of the ground, as the mm-hmm. Genesis account says.
And, of course, in the etymology, we don't
get... raw chemicals.
The word, meaning raw chemical stuff. We don't get the word mm-hmm. dust or dirt or anything like that. And, of mm-hmm. course, all that we're saying, again, I will say, we could not have understood a lot of this, talking about cloning and this kind of thing, until the last 35 years or 50 years.
There is a... one thing, I'm going to take a break for commercials and then get to the callers, but there was one thing that a doctor friend of mine was so taken by what you had to say. As the story progressed and the Celestials were going to have to take their technology and leave, that these new life forms that they had replicated, tall and erect, were never intended really to give birth. That their children were to come by this cloning process.
The pelvic was not
right.
intended to be that.
So they had to do some genetic engineering to cause them to give birth in the natural way as their hominid ancestors had on this planet, because the technology was leaving. The space window the launch window was there. They had to go because of the political and military problems they were having. And that's the reason that it's only the female human being that has birth pains. Uh-huh. It's a painful birth because the body was never intended to do that in the first place.
Exactly, Bill. And when the Lord God says, well, what is this you've done? What is this you've done? Now you will bear children in pain. So that led us to say, well, now what could that have possibly meant? If he says, now you're going to, what happened before that? So we began to run it down. And it was never intended. We're never intended to have any pain because we're never intended to bear children. And that
it was to take the DNA imprint of the father and the mother and incubate that baby elsewhere, right?
And now we've swung full circle, and our own geneticists and biologists and pediatricians are talking about doing this same thing again in the very near future.
Well, I was talking to F.M. Espondiari, who was with us one night, who was a futurist, and F.M. says, indeed, this is the way it's going to be, and how much better it will be for the mother, how much better it will be for the child. That environment of its growth period there, its gestation period, will be perfectly controlled. They won't have the problems. And it's kind of an interesting thing that you're saying. It's all beginning to come true, isn't it?
Yeah.
Perhaps we have provoked a few questions among those who are listening. Shall we get to them?
That's
we
true.
Shall, in just a moment. I'm Bill Jenkins with the Gladdens on Open Mind. Mind.
Yes, thank you. I would like to ask Lee and Vivian Gladden about the issue of Christ. That's assuming that he is a clone. If we take it from there, if they could explain a little bit about the mission and why he's here and just what they found.
Excellent question.
Very good.
Good evening, Dave. That's a wonderful question.
Thank you.
We do explain this in our book, Heirs of the Gods, Dave. We have a chapter called The Redeemer, in which we deal... Remember, this is an interpretation of the Bible, not an interpretation of our own ideas about Jesus. And so we state that the Bible does indicate that Jesus came to bring the religion of the Celestials, their understanding of the ultimate creative power, to men, and to serve as an example by his own life of the celestial way of life that they followed on another world.
Okay.
And that power, being the Holy Spirit or the Holy Ghost or the biocosmic energy, this energy of which... Paul speaks when he says, in which we live and move and have our being. the same energy by which Jesus healed and which we can heal today. The Comforter, it's called, the Paraclete, but the celestials, God, Jehovah, and the angels, or the heavenly hosts, as it speaks of by David in the Psalms, they have learned to order their lives by this energy. And this is what we mean when we talk about the plan of salvation and the ethic of Jesus.
You know, I think it's kind of an interesting thing to note, Dave. If I, we can get back to the Genesis again, whenever these new beings came into
yes.
being, that some amazing new attributes were given to this life form that lived on this planet.
Always, yes.
Suddenly, with the Cro-Magnon man, let's say, there was an interest in beauty. There was an interest in creativity. There was an interest in art and sculpture and humor. There was an interest in forces greater than themselves, whereas the other hominins here, the Neanderthals, the rest of them, were just primitive animals, and their only concern was for survival.
Reduced to their drive.
That's right. Yes. And with the influx of this new person, a lot of attributes of its character and personality were given to it that had nothing to do with survival at all. In fact, probably was detrimental to it.
Mm-hmm. With evolution, we don't need... We speak in our book about the unearthly traits, and we don't need poetry and music and literature or science, any of these things to
survive.
And our minds, our brains, the fact that we are what we are, we mirror, our minds most mirror these gods.
So we were created in the image of
We were created in the image. It says, let us make man in our image after our likeness. And in the Old and New Testament, we're told, ye are gods. In Psalms, it says, ye are gods and children of the Most High. And, of course, when you look up the word there, as you know, Elohim, mm-hmm. you get God, goddess. You get... magistrate or judge, and angels, and we are their children, we're heirs of the gods, and
I think you'll find too that with what Jesus was teaching was not only that you could live this celestial life in a very, very primitive time. It was a rough time that that was happening.
Very rough.
But you also, the teachings of Jesus brought on the idea that there is greater powers within yourself. We might want to call those psychic powers.
Mm-hmm.
That you can now start using to enhance the world that you live in and enhance the quality of your own life to the point that you, by faith, can indeed move mountains.
And that this power within yourself is a... reflection, or actually a continuity with the ultimate creative power of the universe, the Logos, as it's called in John, or Word, mm-hmm. it's sometimes translated, and that you can tap into this Logos or Word and use it in your everyday life to perform what we would call miracles.
And that was the first time that teaching came down, was from Jesus, really. Because before that, all of the teaching had really been involved with taking care of your physical needs as you were in the process of maturing and growing.
Certainly nothing like this in the Old Testament, really, although there are many accounts in the Old Testament of people performing miracles. But the idea that anyone can do this just by tapping into the power, and that there is a paraclete or a comforter out there that you can make contact with any time you want, seemed to be a teaching that was new in the Judeo-Christian tradition with Jesus.
Before that, it was just usually the priest who had the not the ability, but they kind of
well, they could summon the help of the extraterrestrials quite
right.
often. They're you know events
and prophets and mm-hmm. They're speaking of miracles. There's one particular miracle, and we say miracle because we don't necessarily understand all of the laws, but they're not. It's really not a phenomenon. It's really not a miracle. The kingdom of heaven is within, and we all have these gifts within us. And again, the root word heaven leads to a word energia, to the word energia, or energia, meaning power or great power. I like to recount a wonderful experience in terms of Jesus' ministry. When the woman who had had the issue of blood touched the hem of his garment, she'd had it for about 13 years, and it says, it goes through a whole rhetoric there of she'd gone to physicians, and it adds she spent all that she had on physicians. Well, that's kind of familiar.
That's nothing new.
Nothing new. And he said, and she was immediately healed. He said, "Who touched me?" His disciples said, "No one touched thee, Lord." The throng pressed thee. He said, "No, someone touched me, for I felt virtue go out of me." And the word virtue, the Greek word, is dunamis, meaning energy and great energy.
Power.
And power, yes.
So there, does that help you a little bit, Dave?
Well, that pretty much answers my question. I had a second part, and that was the miracles and things that were performed, just where did this come from, or the ability to do so, but I think you've covered it pretty well.
Thank you, and thank you for calling, Dave.
Thank you.
Dave, I appreciate it. It was a very good question. You know, before we take a break here for news, which is coming up just a second, Heirs of the Gods, if I wanted to get a copy of that book, where could I get that book?
Well, almost anywhere in the area that our audience tonight is listening. Bill, in the Valley, Cosmic Connection and Dutton's, for example, Bodie Tree in Hollywood, Pegasus out in Long Beach, down in Orange County, the Cypress Park Bookstore, Crystal Cave, Little Professor in Ananda in Riverside, Crystal Cave in Claremont.
And some of the health stores, the Health Cove in Westwood near UCLA, and then Organicville on 3rd in Los Angeles.
If they're not near any of the stores we've mentioned, perhaps their own store, they can call the studio here and order it individually through a post office box.
Yes, do you have that post office box number if you want to give it?
Yes, 716, post office box 716. And that's Beverly Hills, California, 90213. And it should be addressed Heirs of the Gods, Post Office Box 716, Beverly Hills, California, 90213.
So the book is readily available most anywhere around Southern California. It's called Heirs of the Gods, and we're going to discuss some of the other fascinating things to be found in there. It'll certainly make you think about what's been going on, and we will talk about what's going to happen, as is revealed in Heirs of the Gods.
Wonderful.
And in the Bible.
They're coming back.
They are coming back, and quicker than you might think. So hang on to your seat. We'll break for news and be right back. I'm Bill Jenkins with Drs. Lee and Vivian Gladden.
We are beginning to launch. We've already had one to the moon, and after a rather intensive period of activity there, we've more or less retired now from moon involvement for a while, but we're planning to put a manned station on the moon around the turn of this century.
Mm-hmm.
And in the same way, we believe the Bible implies, the book of Revelation in particular, that the celestials at some point long ago, more than 50,000 years ago, picked Earth as a likely site for colonization, came here probably between 40 and 50,000 years ago, seeded the planet with life forms and recreated some that were here, including, from our point of view, most importantly, Homo sapiens in their own image, and that they plan to return now after almost 40 or 50,000 years, probably near the end of this century, to complete that colonization, which was begun at that time, and that they will establish actually a permanent base here, and that we will become part of a galactic-wide confederation, which they have been developing over the millions or billions of years that they've been exploring space.
Do you think they would really want to get involved with what we've turned out to be? Or are they going to have a way to get us in line?
They're their heirs. They have no choice. They are involved.
Yeah.
They will be coming back in which is Eden. New Jerusalem is Eden.
Mm-hmm.
And it will land on Mount Moriah.
Mount Moriah. You're getting that from the Bible.
Oh,
that's
yes.
The book of Revelation and the book of Ezekiel and the book of Genesis all say.
All from the Bible, then.
First, middle, and last.
So that will be the base station there, the, what do you call it, the command post, maybe.
That's where they originally came. That would be the reason for coming back to the same area.
And Eden is the New Jerusalem.
And we can look forward to that between now and the end of the century.
Well,
using the Bible as a reference.
Assuming
point.
That those who were alive at the time Israel was established would still be alive when it returns, that would put it not much beyond the end of the century, considering the present span of human life.
Because that would be at the year 2000, 52 years old is how old you would be if you were born. You wouldn't remember that, so you would have to say a person that was 62 years old, he may remember Israel being reborn then.
Yeah. Matthew 24 gives a wonderful account of that in detail.
Mm-hmm.
I like to give the scripture so that people can,
sure.
as they're reading Heirs of the Gods, they can read the Bible right along with it.
All right.
It's where heirs came from, the Bible.
Sure. Go ahead and read it.
No, I was saying for our listening audience that Matthew 24, wonderful. I'll just read one little scripture here.
Jesus gave the essential clue there, of course. He said, when you see the fig tree put forth its leaves, and of course, for the last 2,000 years, the fig tree has been the national emblem of Israel. And he said that at the time of the end, the fig tree would again put forth its leaves, and that the Jews who had been dispersed throughout the earth, and of course, this happened... soon after the time of Jesus, when the temple was destroyed in A.D. 70 and the Jews mm-hmm. were scattered to the four corners of the earth, that they would once again be gathered again into their homeland and would have a national state. And that's only happened once since then, and that was, as you said, in 1948.
That's one of the most incredible predictions. Who would have thought that the Jewish people, having been as scattered as they were for so many years, would come back there to Israel.
And the most incredible thing was that it was prophesied 2,000 years ago, even before the dispersion occurred.
I sometimes think that these things we call prophecies are not prophecies so much, but it's just looking at the game plan.
Well, we suggest in errors that the celestials, being as advanced as they were, probably had a method of not just prophesying the future, but actually determining specifically what it was. There are several ways this could be done. If you accept the idea that they had mastered space travel and probably move at very nearly the speed of light, one of the consequences of Einstein's theory of relativity is the so-called time dilatation effect,
mm-hmm.
which suggests that if you can get in a craft going at near the speed of light, time almost stands still in the craft. And if you would journey out for a few weeks, say, into space at that speed and return, in the meantime, thousands of years would have passed on the Earth. Now, we at present don't know any way that you could get back to your former time if you did that, although we do have experimental evidence that this would really be the case, that you could journey out 2 or 3 weeks and come back and it'd be 1,000 years later on Earth or 2,000 years later. But if they had mastered some way to return once they had made that trip into the future, then they may have inspected the future personally, and this is how they had such exact knowledge.
To digress for a moment, it's not really that relevant, and it deals with one of the characters in the Bible, that predominant one, that I'm not keen on at all. But anyway, we have Lucifer, or Satan, tempting Jesus, and he says, if you will bow down and worship me and give me the power, I will make you king of the world, or so to speak, or prince of the world. He said, and it tells us that he took him up on a high mountain. Speaking of this clairvoyance or projecting into the future, and showed him all the kingdoms of the world in a moment of time.
Hmm.
We also suggest...
A little time travel.
Unquote, unquote.
Right. Mm-hmm. In the final chapter of our book, They're Coming Back, we discuss an account that's given by John the Revelator in that book, in which he says that he was taken up in what appears to be a UFO, a kind of a craft, and that he was shown what he calls a sea of glass. But when you read it carefully, it suggests that he was actually looking at some kind of a glass screen, like a video screen, and that in this he saw things that were yet to be. It seems to be actually that they had some method of getting a video forecast.
Right.
On some kind of device, not unlike a television set.
Our scientist friends would call that bending space-time.
Yeah.
Which they are doing.
Yeah.
Or some of our quantum physicists have pointed out that events seem to put out feelers, future events, into the present before they actually occur, virtual happenings of some kind. And it may be that they have a sensitive device that can pick up on these and then focus them so as to...
Well, we certainly don't want to limit their technology.
No.
No, we don't.
It's interesting to speculate just what an advanced civilization might be able to do in the way of foretelling the future.
Well, I'm going to foretell the future here for just the next minute or two, and then we'll get to a call by John, who wants to find out more about the primitive tribes and the UFO. I'm Bill Jenkins. With me, Dr. Open Mind. With me, Dr. Lee Gladden, Dr. Vivian Gladden, the proud authors of a proud book that you should have, I think. It's just my opinion. It's called Heirs of the Gods, and John has a question about that. John, welcome aboard.
Thank you, Bill. Hello, Lee and Vivian.
Good evening, John.
I'd like to know if there are any similarities between the biblical descriptions of celestial aircraft and pilots and the descriptions given by very primitive peoples living today when they first see aircraft and pilots or when they are first given rides in aircraft.
We have not dealt with that question specifically in our book, Heirs of the Gods, but it's one that we have come across in talk shows and discussions before.
It's amazing what these talk shows will crop up with.
Yes.
Uh-huh.
And, of course, one of the most interesting kinds of examples of this sort is in connection with a primitive tribe in Africa, as you probably know, the Dogon. Would you say a little about that?
Yes, the Dogon had knowledge of the star Sirius and understood what his companion was, which was a white dwarf. And we've only come to know about this, or the astronomers have only come to become aware of this, I think, in this century. And they claim that beings or gods came out of the sky, and that's how they had this information. They're called the Dogon, and they're in Africa.
There's some Mesoamerican accounts, too, and even ancient Sumerian accounts, as you may know, that tell of beings coming down from the sky in what appear to be crafts, and of the observations of humans who had seen them at the time and how they reacted to them. And the accounts do sound very similar, we think, to the accounts that you get in the Bible, for instance, of Ezekiel's reaction to the craft that he saw, or to some of the accounts that you get in Project Blue Book, which Hynek would classify as encounters of the third sort,
right,
for example.
And there's a lot of that, too, in the oral lore of the Aborigines in Australia.
Yes.
They talk a great deal about the beings from outer space.
Mm-hmm.
And those people are very unusual people, rather mystic, and have some strange mental powers all of their own, which really set them aside.
Actually, the interesting thing is that the reactions of so-called civilized people seem not to be very different from the reactions of Aboriginal people to UFOs or to celestial encounters.
Does that help you, John?
Yes, thank you, Bill.
All right, thank you very much for the question.
Uh-huh.
And we have Chris. Hello, Chris.
Yes, Bill and L.V. Glenn. Yes, in support of the theory and the topic that you guys are speaking of tonight, there's 24 verses in the Bible that refer to, but the most interesting one is St. Luke 24:3-23. And they entered in and found there the body of the Lord Jesus. And it came to pass, as they were much perplexed thereabout, behold, two men stood by them in shiny garments. That's verses 4.
Yes.
Yes.
We quote
and in
that
23,
in
and when they found not his body, they came saying that they had also seen a vision of angel, which said that he was alive.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm.
So
I'm
will you expand
along
on that, please? I'm going to hang up.
Thank you for calling.
Yeah,
yes, thank
this
you.
Is very interesting that verses 4 in St. Luke 24.
Okay, she's following along with you there, Chris. Thank you very much for bringing that to our attention.
Yes, and I'm going to listen on the radio.
I'm happy that you know your Bible so well, too.
Thank you very much.
That was covered in your book, I think.
Yes,
yes.
In the chapter on the Redeemer, where we discuss the crucifixion and the resurrection, we talk about the several different accounts that are given and comment on this particular passage that Chris mentioned.
If you look at Chris...
He hung up, but he's listening.
Verse 51, the Ascension... Verse 51 also tells us, and it came to pass, while he blessed them, he was parted from them and was carried up into heaven.
Mm-hmm. Carried up by what? Up go Vivian's hands. All right.
Spacecraft.
Spacecraft, could
that
be.
That cloud that was covering,
yeah.
Following the children of Israel.
It was with them all the time.
All the time.
As well as the fire.
Mm-hmm. Of course, we have something very close to that now with modern military hardware where soldiers can be elevated off the ground by infantrymen can for
mm-hmm.
short intervals of space. We were not able to do it in so spectacular a manner as seems to be described there, where you would have an ascent into an entry craft that would perhaps then return to a mother ship.
But you see, he was levitating, and the energy was taking him up into... the craft, because before he got into a craft, we're having to deal here with something that's marvelous to do with that energy that we spoke about earlier.
Arthur C. Clarke discusses in his Profiles of the Future the possibility that in the not-too-distant future, we may master anti-gravity, and it may be possible to produce a rather a small portable anti-gravity device that would allow people to duplicate this. The scene that's described.
Not exactly a beam me up Scotty thing, but but something that will allow you to basically do the same thing without scattering your electrons all over.
Yes. Not too far from that.
Okay. Mike, what's on your mind?
Well, Bill, I lose the phone here. I was just kind of wondering if Drs. Lee and Vivian and their studies have come across something that relates to the use of quartz crystals in the Bible or crystals in general.
Well, we're certainly aware of the literature and have read some of it and been in contact with some of the authors who have written in this field. We don't deal with this question specifically in Heirs of the Gods, since our interest there primarily is interpreting the message of the Bible, and we usually deal with these kinds of technical questions only as they relate to the message. Would you want to point your question a little more towards some particular part of the Bible?
At this point, I'm not that well studied enough to go ahead and question. I was wondering if you had uncovered anything in your translation.
There are, for instance, in the description of the Ark of the Covenant, there are some very interesting accounts in Genesis and Exodus about what appear to be jewels that would be crystalline in form that were involved with the Ark of the Covenant, and a suggestion that they might have been used in connection with transmitters of some sort or for producing energies not unlike maybe the ruby laser kind of phenomenon that we're familiar with.
Mike,
mm-hmm.
In Revelation 2, verse 17... we read, "He that hath an ear, let him hear what the Spirit saith to the churches. To him that overcometh will I give to, my Bible is so marked up, and I've got it so patched up. But anyway, it says, to eat of the hidden manna, and will give to him a white stone, and in the stone is the name written, which no man knoweth, saving he that received it. And so that is speaking of, that's Revelation 2. Now, as Lee mentioned a moment ago, if you would want to make a note of this, Revelation 21 gives a marvelous description of the holy city. And it's just, the chapter is just profuse with stones that they obviously are using for all sorts of scientific involvement there.
Precious and semi-precious stones.
Precious and semi-precious.
Which would be crystalline in form.
Yes, and just, if I may, read this to you. This is Revelation 21, and the city lieth four square, and the length is as large as the breadth. And he measured the city with the reed, 12,000 furlongs. The length and the breadth and the height of it are equal. And he measured the wall thereof, and 144 cubits according to the measure of a man, that is, of the angel. Now, the verse before that, the first verse says, and I saw a new heaven and a new earth, for the first heaven and the first earth were passed away. And I, John, saw the holy city, New Jerusalem, coming down from God out of heaven, prepared as a bride adorned for her husband. So we're speaking of the New Jerusalem, or Eden.
And in that connection, let me add just a moment that Isaac Asimov, in his book, Is Anyone There?, tells how our own futurologists are saying that in the near future we will be able to construct city-sized spacecraft which will be used for journeys between the stars. And there seems to be very little question here that what John the Revelator is describing is a city-sized craft of some sort that comes down
a mile square, about
right
there.
And, Mike, and the building of the wall of it was of jasper, and the city was pure gold, like unto clear glass. And the foundations of the wall of the city were garnished with all manner of precious stones. The first foundation was jasper, the second sapphire, the third a chalcedony, the fourth an emerald, the fifth sardonyx, the sixth sardius, the seventh chrysolite. There you are, chrysolite. The eighth beryl, the ninth a topaz, the tenth a chrysophosphorus, the 11th a jacinth, the 12th an amethyst, and the last, verse 21, reading from chapter 21 in Revelation, the 12 gates were 12 pearls, and every several gate was of one pearl, and the street of the city was pure gold, and it as it were transparent glass. And
we suggest in errors that these weren't actually the jewels that are described here, but that they resembled them, and we're dealing with synthetic materials of some sort in many cases that may have had either special kinds of scientific functions or more may have been selected for their structural properties.
Or using the crystals themselves for.
Or using the crystals for specific scientific purposes, as we've used the ruby, for instance, to generate lasers.
Yes.
Or as Dale Walker and a couple of other associates of mine have been using them for some recent work, as I'm sure Bill will remember the beginning chapters of Dale's book.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, certainly. Mm-hmm.
And for healing and all sorts of wonderful things. I certainly believe in.
Well, it was quite a city. It certainly wasn't the description of Reseda.
Or Long Beach, for that matter. That's not sure.
May I have your full name?
You may have, Bill, if that's okay with you.
Usually we just have the first
name. Oh, I should say, what is your first name?
Mike.
Mike, Excuse me, he said he was dealing with, do you have a book on it?
No, I'm not. I'm dealing with Master Ho and Dale Walker.
Oh, I see.
And we have been doing some work with, in fact, I'm recording the show for Ho this evening, working down in San Diego.
I see.
Oh, we'll give our best to Ho.
I will do that.
Thank you for calling.
Thank you very, very much.
All right, Mike, appreciate your call. Tonight it's Open Mind, and we challenge your open mind. We're talking about the Bible and how it's talking about how we're related to the people from Arcturus.
The only planetary systems that we've been able to detect with any high degree of probability are those of our very nearest neighbors, not more than 4 to 8 light years away. There are perturbations in their motion in the sky that suggests that they have planetary systems around them, and astronomers assume now that that's evidence. And Carl Sagan assumes that planets are probably the rule rather than the exception, that most stars probably have planetary systems.
They just grow wild like weeds everywhere, don't they? Okay. It's Open Mind tonight. We'll be right back with a question from Bob. He wants to hear about the burning bush.
Oh.
All right, I'm Bill Jenkins, Open Mind. Doctors Lee and Vivienne Gladden are here. We're talking about their book called Heirs of the Gods and some of the amazing things that they have found in the Bible. And Bob wanted to ask about the burning bush, I think, Bob.
I wanted to make a comment. First of all, I'd like to just mention on your previous caller, you mentioned Beryl in the Holy City, which was also mentioned in Ezekiel. In regard to the appearance of the craft. However, in reading of Nikola Tesla biographies recently, several. But if you look at those pictures of him, with some of them which we know were rigged pictures, but other ones weren't, with electric flashes coming out of them. And he's sitting there unharmed.
Mm-hmm.
I myself, in an earlier carnival thing, was up there having the voltage run through me and lighting light bulbs and having my hair stand on end with it, so I've experienced it and I know it's harmless. That could have been the means and the visual means of creating a burning bush, and lasers could have emblazoned and burned the laws into the tablets.
What's called a corona?
Phenomenon. We evidently have a high scientific skills that were present in those periods of time.
Mm-hmm. Well, the guards to the Garden of Eden, are,
yes,
as they are described, certainly could be a robot type of sentry.
Well, we found that in the etymology, that the cherubims and the flaming sword, the Hebrew word there is kebab, and we get a laser beam for the flaming sword, and but back to the burning bush. Also, the energy of God, or the Lord God, would emit that kind of.
Well, interestingly, Alec Hynek recounts cases which are taken from Project Blue Book's reports on close encounters, in which witnesses who have claimed to see landed UFOs have seen phenomena like burning fires near the craft where they had landed. And this sounds very much like an encounter of the third kind, the account of Moses and the burning bush, as though there were a spacecraft that had settled somewhere near, and the voice that he was hearing was perhaps over a PA system. It could have been, of course, an inner subjective vision, but it can just as readily be interpreted as one more instance of a UFO account of the what Hynek would call a close encounter sort.
And how could Moses pretty well describe a UFO anyway? It was just totally outside of his frame of reference.
There's another much more typical Blue Book type of account, of course, where it says that there was apparently a craft that came down on the top of a mountain with rumbling and shaking, and that flames went out of it, and then Moses ascended up to it. And when he came back down, his face shone, it says. And interestingly, then in the New Testament, we have an almost parallel account where Jesus goes up to the Mount of Transfiguration with two of the disciples, and he sees and has communication with the occupants in a close encounter of the third kind, as Hynek would call it. And when he comes down, his face shines again.
A lot of energy going on.
A lot of energy.
Some of it has to do with Tesla coils, which can create this kind of thing, or what we call Tesla coils, obviously, if they existed in the Bible times,
yes,
before Tesla, and they had another name for them.
Yes, you're relating it to the Tesla coil phenomenon and to the corona discharge phenomenon is a very interesting parallel, I think.
A verbal footnote there in terms of Moses having come down from the mount and his face shining. When he came down, the people were told not to look at him. They had to turn their backs because he was...
I remember.
Yes, yes. So that would be in accord with what you're speaking of.
How long did it take Moses to tone down? Does it ever tell us?
It doesn't, that I recall, say how long this phenomenon lasted after he had come down.
That's an interesting question.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Does that help you, Bob?
Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Good question. To know your Bible. We'll be right back. We have Marge on the line who has... she may not totally agree with you two. You ready to take on Marge?
We're happy to speak with her.
All right. We'll be to Marge in just a moment.
Interesting.
I'm me. They are the authors of Heirs of the Gods, and I understand, Marge, that you don't exactly go along with what they're saying here.
Okay, Bill, am I on?
You are on.
Good evening, Marge.
Can you hear me, Bill? I want to talk to you first.
Okay, we are.
I've listened to you for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
You put me in touch with Marcel Vogel.
Yes.
And Dr. Manners in England.
Mm-hmm.
And I've written to both of them, and I do have telekinetic ability. I did bend a spoon, and you didn't, did you?
No, I haven't. Well, not real good.
Never.
I've worked on it a little bit more.
Okay, Drs. Lee and Vivian Gladden.
Yes, Mom.
Yes.
Your book sounds fascinating. Where can I get it?
Well,
Heirs of the Gods. Is it in the library?
It's in most of the libraries that we're
Where do you live, Marge, in the Los Angeles area?
I live in Arcadia. Yes, it is in the Los Angeles area.
Yes. In the Los Angeles area, some of the bookstores that are carrying it are Cosmic Connection out in the valley, or Dutton's, or Bodie Tree in Hollywood.
Yeah.
Those would all be
Cosmic
not too
Connection.
Far from your area.
Is that the name of a bookstore?
Yes, those are bookstores.
Or the Bodie Tree.
I love that cosmic idea.
Bodie Tree on Melrose, or the health store.
A lot of the New Age bookstores are carrying it, but then many of the standard bookstores, such as Dutton's, which is not too far from you, is also carrying it.
Well, I'm certainly interested in reading your hypothetical theory, which I regard it as such, just like mine is hypothetical. Where did you get this name of this planet?
We got that out of the Book of Job.
Job 38, canst thou bind the sweet influences of the Pleiades? Or loose
name the planet?
Or loose the bands of Orion? Canst thou bring forth Maseroth in his season? Or canst thou guide Arcturus with his sons?
Yeah.
Job 38, 31 and 32.
Right here in front of me.
And the reference to Arcturus there... and Maseroth connected with it, which has an interpretation when you get into the etymology. One of the possible interpretations is a planet.
I see.
And this
one
suggests...
One has to be pretty sort of, pardon me, far out to interpret this, right?
Well, when you speak of a planet, when you speak of a sun, a star, a sun, Arcturus, and his sons, S-O-N-S, the Hebrew word there is Ben, of course.
Uh-huh.
You mean heavenly bodies that
I
in
see.
Some way are dependent on the primary body, and that would either have to mean that it's a double star, which
uh-huh.
we know it is not. Modern astronomy is accurate enough to be sure of that.
Yeah.
So the only other possibility is that it is referring to a planetary system around Arcturus, and that Maseroth is one of its planets.
Is it the only one it names, but there may be others.
Yes.
Oh, excuse me here, Leon, the word Nazir, we actually got the word planet that came from Maseroth.
I see.
Yes,
right. You see.
Well, I just wonder where that leaves me out in left field as a so-called, quote-unquote, born again.
Well, that just brings you right into the fold.
Pardon me?
That brings you right into the fold.
Did you ever, I'm sure you did, I've read it 3 or 4 times before it happened to me, in a very small, humble way, cosmic consciousness.
Yes.
Where man evolves. There's 3 kinds of consciousness. Simple, the animals have. Self, we have as humans. And cosmic, that Jesus...
Yes, we have a good many books in our library about cosmic consciousness.
Huh?
And it's something we deal with in our chapter called Pentecost and Biocosmic Energy.
Yeah.
That's our 13th.
Okay,
chapter 13 in our book.
Denying that.
Uh-huh.
That's pretty much covered in the Bible, what you might want to call the cosmic cosmos.
I can hear your old voice there. How are you, Bill? Are you saying that you think man was not materialized, or I'm wondering about this business of impregnating Mary's womb and all that.
Well, we're not saying that, of course. Well, what we're saying is that John is saying that in the Gospel of John.
Can you quote that so I can write it down with
Luke? And Luke.
And Luke also, but notably, you get it in John, where he speaks of, as we said, Jesus being the only begotten Son.
Yeah.
And the Greek word there, monogenes, means monogenetic son.
I see.
And if you study what a monogenetic offspring is in modern biology, you'll see that it means a clone.
And in Luke, when Gabriel comes to Mary, he says, this thing that will be born of you will be of the Holy Ghost. You will be overshadowed. And the word there, the Greek word is episkiazo. And as I said earlier in the program, that gives you the meaning of a brilliant haze.
I see.
That impregnation was by some kind of a radiation of energy rather than...
I do believe in energy, don't you?
Oh,
the whole universe.
Most definitely.
That's all there is.
That's what the universe is all
about.
The whole thing is energy. Does
both modern physics and the Bible seems to teach that.
I'm listening to you, Marge.
You're going to cut me off, aren't you?
Yeah, it's time.
No, you're not.
We got to go. I really appreciate your question, Marge.
Yeah.
And I hope this helped you.
Well, thank you very, very much.
Thank you, Marge.
Thank you. We enjoyed your question.
I will read your book with earnest endeavor.
All right. I hope you do.
Bye-bye.
We'll get to Jim in just a moment.
And Vivian, glad and I read your book about a year and a half ago or so.
Oh, did she,
though? Yeah. And I remember at one point in the future, you referred to the fact that everyone who had ever lived on this planet would be brought to life again, and we would all, according to our spirituality, find our separate areas.
The Bible says this, we believe, yeah.
Okay. And so the way that the people were brought back, it sounded like there were many ways, but one of them was these people from Maseroth had... they'd have a record of the code of each person's life. All they needed was a sample, like from a skeleton, for instance.
A record of their genetic code.
Yeah, and wherever they got this, so it could be a number of ways. And however, I noticed that the word reincarnation was never really referred to in your book, and this is what I was curious about.
Well, of course, this would be literally a reincarnation. Paul comes close to using that term in the New Testament when he speaks about a new body. But if you take a person whose original body has totally disappeared, it's been obliterated, nothing is left of it, say he's been cremated or he's... been drowned in the ocean and his body is disintegrated or is disintegrated in the grave. And then you reconstruct this person from a record of his genetic code, which was made while he was living. The new body would be a reincarnation of his personality. It wouldn't be reincarnation in quite the sense, say, the Hindus speak of it, but it would certainly be reincarnation.
In Job 14:14, we read, if a man die, shall he live again? All the days of my appointed time will I wait until my change come. Thou shalt call, and I will answer thee. Thou wilt have a desire to do the work of thine hand. And we all know the magnificent work of Handel. For I know that my Redeemer liveth, and that he shall stand at the latter day upon the earth. And though after my skin worms destroy this body, yet in my flesh shall I see God, whom I shall see for myself, and mine eyes shall behold, and not another, though my reins be consumed within me. And very quickly, chapter 13, 1 Corinthians, Paul speaking, St. Paul. But when that which is perfect, whole, that's what perfect means, we hear a lot about holistic today, but when that which is perfect is come, then that which is in part shall be done away. When I was a child, I spake as a child, I understood as a child, I thought as a child, but when I became a man, I put away childish things. For now we see through a glass darkly, but then face to face. Now I know in part, but then shall I know even as I am also known.
There's one other thing, too, Jim. It might be interesting to mention, though it's not in the Bible that you were working with. The early writers, like Origen and St. Augustine, talked a great deal about reincarnation.
Yes.
And certainly if the spiritual presence of us after our physical life is gone is in this earth area, there is all the genetic or the encoding necessary to bring you back into life.
And we discussed this in our final chapter. They're coming back. We discuss several alternative methods of resurrection, and one of them would involve a resurrectional energy.
Okay.
All right. Does that help you, Jim?
Yeah, really.
All right. Thank you
for calling.
Good question. And thank both of you for coming by.
Thank you, Bill.
Our time is done, and it looks like we just got started.
It's nice to be home again.
Now, to get that book, the Bodhi Tree, a couple of the stores around, or just write to you, care of me here at the radio station. I'll get it to you, and you'll take care of it.
Thank you.
Okay?
Thank you.
And,
it's been wonderful being here with you again.
Bill has.
It's so good to see you again. So that book is great, Heirs of the Gods. Read it. Keep it in your library. It'll make everybody think. We'll see you next week, and we'll talk more about the UFOs. I'll have a surprise for you then.
Happy celebration 25.